tonight. Because it is actually my privilege, my honor, you know, to be called Reyes' friend. When I came out of rehab, my first week going around the circle finding meetings, I came across Rainbow, and I met Reyes at Rainbow. And, of course, he asked me to share, because they usually do that when we get a stranger in the room, you know, you're going to share the meeting tonight. And it was my first time. I was really nervous, and he made me feel at such peace, because that's what Reyes really, there's so many friends of Reyes here tonight. We have a full house because that speaks highly of who he is, you know, the amount of people that came to support him today. See that? Right there. He is from Visalia, and this is funny because I was laughing when I asked him, well, how many years? He said, well, 31 years, 364 days. And then somebody said, you know, he still can screw that up, even though tomorrow is his birthday. So I highly doubt that. So it is my honor, really, and my privilege to introduce to you guys a very good friend of mine, Reyes. So give him the biggest applause you have in you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Reyes. I am an alcoholic. I don't like talking in mics. Thank you very much. And I'm only nervous for a few seconds, so it's so good to see Frank and other friends of mine here tonight. It says something for I'm a little bit nervous, but I'll get going. Because this isn't normal for me, where I came from and what I did, and all these, you know, the years are just days that, you know, that are adding up. So I'm going to share some stuff, and I've talked to some really good friends of mine. I have some amazing friends because of this program, and I let them know that, you know, because of recovery in my life and working and living a spiritual program, I've learned pretty much to filter my story. When I was first brought into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't understand how this program worked. I thought it was like group therapy, and you talked about what you did out there, and I'll get to a little bit. I'll only hit a little bit of stuff because I don't like making people uncomfortable about where alcohol and drugs took me, because drugs was a big part of my existence as well. I am mezcalero. My people are all in the New Mexico and Texas area. I come from a very long line of alcoholics. I'm one of the first generations that started experimenting and abusing drugs. Prior to that, it was a lot of drinking. Where I come from, it was okay for the boys to drink, and I was like 5 years old, 6 years old, and I mentioned this because back in that area, I don't know if they still make them, but they had these little half beers, and they would give it to the boys, and the girls weren't allowed to drink. So it was okay. My message in for myself in Alcoholics Anonymous is all the mixed messages that I was receiving as I was growing up. The one about it was okay to drink, that they would beat us so that we wouldn't cry, because boys don't cry, men don't cry. So I had some things really jacked up in my life early on emotionally. I'm also a survivor of sexual abuse. Because of my addiction, I ended up with a food problem. Just really messed up. And what I want to share briefly about is, you know, they talk about, you know, experience, strength, and hope, you know, qualifying. You know, I belong in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't like to just go on and on about my drunkalog. That's not what it's about for me today. It's about how I stay sober today and how I stay spiritually fit, and how the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous has given me an amazing, amazing life with all the problems. And I do. I have problems. I'm just doing life. I have problems, financial problems, health problems, but I'm still alive. And I'm here. And like I said, this is not normal for me to do. Even though I've shared in at speaker meetings before, it still makes me uncomfortable because I have to filter some of my story. But there's nothing, I'll share this right now, there is nothing that I will not share with another human being, another man or woman in my life on a one-on-one basis of my own personal experience where alcohol and drugs took me. Because it, the way I drank and the way I used and without the money that I had, and I had to drink, I did some really despicable things, even prostituting myself. I was 16 years of, well, let me go get before that. When I was started to drink, what I consider my first real drinking was I was about 10 or 11 years of age, and it was a it was only 80 proof Bacardi. Didn't know about mixing or anything. And when I think back about this and I bring this up, it really shows about how alcoholic I am, because I left a little bit in the bottle because I didn't want to get in trouble for drinking the whole bottle, you know. So, but I got extremely sick. And by this time, I was already being abused and already been through a whole bunch of stuff, you know. But alcohol, and I was even having blackouts before, and that's something I'll share about a little bit also is the blackouts I was having. I was having mental and emotional blackouts because of the things that I was enduring. And then I survived, and I understand today why young people kill themselves, because I attempted suicide a couple of times in my early teenage years. When I share my story with somebody on a one-on-one basis, you know, I scare myself sometimes because it was long ago. But this is a cunning, baffling, powerful disease, and it doesn't care how much time we have. It doesn't care how much time I have or what I've given into my sobriety bank. You know, it's waiting to get me if I don't stay spiritually fit and if I don't step up and do this. I read in the Central Newsletter a little saying that the speaker at Springville said, you know, if it's not inconvenient, it's not service, you know. So, and it is inconvenient for me to stand in front of people, and today I can honestly say, you know, judging and all that stuff, you know, it's just, you know, I'm a two-spirited Native American, and I'm very proud of who I am and my people. And I'm very proud of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sober a lot of years before I got comfortable with that phrase about being a grateful alcoholic, because I didn't want another label put on me. I had a lot of labels before I was brought in here. My drinking numbed everything. I had one emotion, and that was anger. I was an extremely angry young man. I got in a lot of fights. I've been shot at, bar fights, street fights, alley fights. I was a fighter. And when I look back about that period of my life, I just wanted somebody to take me out. I had so much anguish. I was so messed up, and I didn't know. I didn't know how to ask for help. Where we're from, and I will put my one of, I like it. God, it's just hard to talk about sometimes. The stuff that they put us through, we weren't raised really to be prejudiced. And I come from an area where we even were forced to go to segregated churches. And when we were at an integrated church, we sat in the back of the church. And preacher, I remember, I was a young man at that time, and I remember the preacher, you know, we were in the back, and he'd be like pointing and yelling at us. That's why maybe I'm uncomfortable up here at the pulpit. But he would be calling us heathens, and I didn't know what heathens were, but I knew we were going to hell and all this stuff, and it was like, I didn't know what that was about. And we were raised not to ask white people for anything. I didn't know what a black person looked like till we came to California. And it really was like that. It was an extremely uncomfortable, unsettling when I understood that was going on in my life. When you're in it, just like I thought I had I didn't have a Leave It to Beaver family, by no means, you know, but I thought everybody's family was like that, abusive, controlling. We had to, like, know what my dad was thinking, or he just beat you. And he was a daily drinker. My dad did not make it through the doors of this program. He died quite a few years ago, but I was fortunate enough to make my amends with that man before he died. Anyway, what ended up happening was my drinking took off My anger escalated with it. My drug of choice with alcohol was 151. I almost beat a man up in a bar one time because he lit my drink on fire. And I didn't know 151 could light on fire. I made him buy me two drinks and some other stuff. Back then, I was sharing with somebody just recently, you know, that I used to go to happy hours and the drinks were like 75 cents, you know, for this. And I'd be broke in a weekend the way the prices are now. But I started going to bars when I was 16 years of age. It was a lot easier back then to get in there. I noticed right off the bat that people would watch people playing pool. And I didn't have, again, you know, I didn't have money to go do what I was doing. So I'd be stealing it and so forth like that. But I noticed people playing pool, and I noticed people watching people playing pool. I said, so I learned how to start playing pool. And they were, you know, for drinks and money and things like that. And I got very good. And not bragging about anything, I got extremely good. I was a little pool shark. And I did extremely well with my pool playing. I was in some tournaments and so forth like that later on. And the pool stick was a really good tool or weapon with some of my bar fights too. So that was also a comfort for me, having my 151. I was smoking 2.5-3 packs of Marlboro Reds, you know, every day. And back then, a carton was only $7.50, you know. And now, like I said, I'd be dead and broke by now if I was still doing that behavior today. But anyway, what ended up happening was when I was drinking, the way I was drinking and using people and abusing myself and not understanding why these things were happening. You know, I accepted the fact early on in my life that I was crazy. Because, I didn't know about blackouts. That's what I was going to bring that up. I was going to talk about that. I didn't know what blackouts were. I had every intention to go out and have fun, go disco dancing, you know, and have a good time, you know. And I wake, you know, come to and say, who are you and where are we? I would go on trips and sometimes come to on an airplane. I know I came to once in, there's a lot of places I went and didn't know how I got there, but I had a good time. I always made sure I had a good time. I made sure everybody else did too, because I wanted to be liked. I just wanted to fit in. I had a friend of mine, and I'm going to share this, you know, because it's important for me to state how deadly this disease is. The majority of the men and women that I knew when I was younger are dead. There's probably four, maybe five of us that are still alive. I was brought in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 25 years of age. I have one sobriety date, and that's the 5th of February, 1983. And I'm 57 years of age today because I haven't, and I'm sober, and, you know, I haven't drank and I haven't died. That's how you become a long-timer. That's just it. But there's so much more about having serenity that comes about, and what I'll share about working and living this program. What ended up happening was my behavior got out of control. I really was. I was a menace to society. I was a blackout drunk driver, and I only got 3 502s or DUIs. And back then, you know, even I tell some people that one of the times I wrote a check for $500. You know, they took it. You know, that took care of one of my DUIs, and that was how crazy it was back then. When they pull us over and they find beer or anything in our vehicles or trucks, they'd have us pour it out, or some of the bad cops would just take it and put it in their truck, in their car, and go. I know they were drinking and stuff like that. So I had a lot of behavior that went on that was, like I said, was very menacing out there in the world. And what ended up happening for me was one of the times I was looking at prison time because I almost killed a man. And it's one thing I don't like to talk about, but that's where alcohol took me. I can't minimize something like that, how violent my behavior got. I didn't like tall white men. There was something about, I figured out what that was. It was about the preacher. You know, it was a tall white preacher that was growing up. And I understand that today and why I just had this thing about when I see a tall white man walk into a bar, you know, I just like, it was just on. I just wanted to, yeah, beat the hell out of him. I just like, it was just, and because I was sick. I was a very sick person. And that's why I said, you know, this program has been, it saved my life and saved other people's lives too. It really has. Just because I tell people, just because I'm sober doesn't mean I'm, you know, well. You know, I don't have blackouts, but I can red out. I really can. As long as what ended up happening was this last time that I was being sentenced by the judge in Fresno. And even getting sentenced, I didn't stop me from my drinking and using. I thought it was my 151 that was causing the problem. So near the last year of my drinking and using, I switched. Like it talks about, my life is in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's explained there truly in black and white. And I switched from that scotch to brandy type of stuff. I just switched from 151 to everything else. I just so much. The only thing I did not do were needles. I smoked heroin and ate it and all kinds of pills and laced joints and even cigarettes with PCP. I just named the drug from the 70s and freebase cocaine in the early 80s, all to, you know, fit in, to have a good time. And the cocaine actually was, for me, which is a bad thing, would help me drink more. But man, it hurt my jaws after a few days. But I didn't want to miss anything, so I was going places. I was always going places, you know. I didn't want to miss out on anything. And what ended up happening, I was missing out on life. I truly was missing out on life. Like I said, there's not enough time to talk about that tragic stuff, but I really want to focus on what happened because when I was given the opportunity to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had never thought about not drinking. And I was so fortunate to walk in or be taken to the Fresno Fellowship in Fresno. But what had happened was it was the 5th of February, and the month before, January 5th of 1983, was when I was last sentenced. And I was supposed to do all these things to be in compliance. And so I understand what people, if you're in a treatment program or court order, so that I have that. You know, I have empathy for you. I wasn't going to give up alcohol. I couldn't see living without it. I didn't know how to. I had no means of getting up and doing life without drinking. There were times when I don't want to forget this. Last night I went on a 12-step call and the guy, you know, I helped him pour out the booze and, as I always showed, you turn cold water on when you're dumping alcohol down the sink so you don't get the vapors up and you can trigger stuff, blah, blah, blah. And anyway, we were out on the patio because he wanted to have a cigarette. Well, what he was trying to do was get to this cup on the table, and then I was watching, what are you trying to do? And he goes, well, I'm thinking about drinking that or not. And I go, what is it? And he goes, well, it was liquor, but but it's got a cigarette in it or something. And I said, oh, he goes, I did that, you know, because that's how bad it was for me. I could not get out of bed without reaching over and drinking whatever was next to me. And I did that. I spit out the cigarette butt and finished drinking so I could get up and do what I had to do for the day. There were times I'd pass out, and I used to have cigarette burns on my chest where the cigarette would burn out on my chest. It's amazing, and God was looking after me then before I even believed in God. You know, I could have easily burned down my apartment and killed people, kill myself, but it didn't happen, you know. But the way I slept or passed out, you know, it just like laid on me, and I had, like, wake up with burns on me. There were a couple of times I overdosed, and when anyone has overdosed and didn't get help, and you're laying in a bed for a couple of days, it's not that pretty. You know, you kind of stuck to the sheets and everywhere, and it just was horrible. And I thought, well, it was just bad drugs, you know. I never put the two and two together. What ended up happening was when I was sentenced to a program, and I called my friend Richard, who was already in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he took me to my first meeting, because when I called him, that February 5th, it was in the morning, I was sitting on my filthy floor of my apartment, and it was the longest drink, I always remember this, it was the longest drink I ever drank, and it took me 30 minutes to drink that drink. And my experience, this is when alcohol stopped working, because it was like I couldn't smell it, I couldn't taste it, I couldn't anything. The alcohol literally, the burn wasn't there, the smell wasn't there, the effect that I needed to quell my insanity and make things okay, it stopped. It had stopped. I don't know if it was the next day or whatever, but I remember calling my friend Richard because I said, I don't feel good. I'd never had withdrawals, really. So he said, oh, you're just having DTs. You know, they'll go away in a couple of days. And so he'd come and pick me up and take me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had about 6 or 7 days of very serious withdrawals. And back then, they didn't have styrofoam cups. They had mugs and beakers and stuff. And I would shake so bad that I couldn't sit still. I was just shaking. I couldn't drink my coffee. And I got to share this. There was an angel in that meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that stood behind me and helped me drink my coffee. And to this day, that still touches me, because I was unlovable. And I didn't want people touching me. I didn't want people to look at me. And here I was in a room full of white people who I thought were all old. Well, they were older than me. They were like 30, you know. And I was 25 and thought I knew everything. And I was invincible, because I said, you don't know what I've been through. You don't know what I've seen. You don't know what I've done. And yeah, well, I've stuck around long enough where I've heard my story through women, through other men of color, through sexual orientations. You know, I didn't choose to be alcoholic. I didn't choose the color of my skin. I didn't choose to be sexually oriented different. But I embraced all of my life. God doesn't make junk. And what ended up happening was I went through my withdrawals, that first set, and I had about 4 days of calm. And then I had, when I woke up in the morning, for some reason, and I had never had withdrawals before. And I remember waking up and I was shaking again, and for some reason I knew I was going to have another set of withdrawals. And I did. I had about 4 or 5 days of serious, just as intense as the first set of withdrawals that I had. And once then, my friend Richard kept picking me up and taking me to meetings. And back then, they wouldn't let newcomers talk. I remember that, because they said, oh, you can't tell us a different way to get drunk. You know, you need to shut up and listen to how this program works. And I always say so. They were mean to me, you know, and I had a feeling, my own feeling. I was an angry young man, you know, I was just pissed all the time. So I sat there and I listened, and people kept welcoming me back. And then when I started to share, again, like I said, I didn't have filters. I didn't know how this worked. So I thought everybody did sexual stuff, and I thought everybody did what I did. But it was, yeah, the ones that I was hanging around, the lowlights and so forth, because that was my existence, you know. These people had already bettered their lives and had been in a program of recovery, and they were sober, and I didn't understand any of that stuff. And they were all white. I figured they had a little group that they were all part of, and I wasn't. I wasn't part of the group, you know. And anyway, what ended up happening was people kept telling me, well, you really need to get a sponsor and talk about that outside of the meeting. And I'd go, what the hell? Because again, I was raised not to ask white people for help. And that's all the word in the room. I said, they didn't understand, because they didn't know me. They didn't know where I'd come from and what had been instilled in my head. And how difficult, and that's what I want to share, you know, tonight, how difficult it was for me to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the saving grace was, I remember hearing that said, if you drank every day, you go to a meeting every day, you know, and I drank a lot, so I went to like 2, 3, sometimes 4 meetings a day, and I did that for almost 2 years. It was a good year and a half that I was going to 3 meetings a day, sometimes 4 meetings a day, and then I went down to like 2 a day, and I still have commitment meetings to this today. I still have commitment meetings. I have a home group. My sponsor died a year and a half ago. I'll talk about that in a minute. Anyway, I went through my withdrawals. I talked to these people. They were sharing about getting the sponsor. I got this guy, this big white guy in leather, you know. Bill Moore was his name, and I figured he could probably handle me. And he guided me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, because he would share with me that, he says, you know, for every step there's a spiritual principle. He goes, and then we will talk about traditions. And, you know, he made sure that I became a part, and that I was a part of Alcoholics Anonymous, not in the fringes, but he got me involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous was to be a greeter. And again, like I mentioned, I didn't like to be touched, don't look at me, and he knew this. And it was a baby step for me in my growth. So, I already said that I would go to any links, you know, and take any suggestions that my sponsor gave me. And sure enough, that's what I did. I was a greeter for the Fresno Fellowship. And it was quite a while, a couple months, until my sponsor told me that he would get there early. He said, get there early and you become a greeter, blah, 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 you know. And it was some time before he told me that he would get there before I did, to make sure that I was doing that, you know. He's checking up on me. But I did it. And I don't know if I should talk about the boobies or not, but I didn't like to be touched, and I never think about women, you know, and boobs and stuff like that. And the women like to hug, you know, like, oh, these boobs. You know, it was like, God, it was just like, drive me crazy, you know. So I, right away, women are coming up, I'd have my hand out there, you know, and they would like push it aside and grab me, and oh, boobs. So I went to any length to get my sobriety. I really did. I'm serious. It was very uncomfortable for me to be in these rooms, or even to be outside the door. What ended up happening was, with my sponsor, he, again, about the steps and stuff like this, you know, and about service, and he got me involved in 12-step calls. And back then, we did some serious 12-step calls, you know, getting up at, you know, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning and going out. I mean, I went to Rowing Park in the middle of the night to pick somebody up. And I did 12-step calls. I still do, like I said, I did one last night. I'm still available to do those, because that is what attracts me to this program, to remember. Because you hear people, well, I go to meetings to see what happens to people that stop going to meetings, you know? And that's true. This is a very serious, serious disease that I have. And if you're an alcoholic or addict, join the club, because just last month, one of our members at my men's meeting in Fresno relapsed, and he died within 3 weeks. So within the last 2 years, I had two cousins of mine died. They were just a few years younger than me. One put at 9 o'clock in the morning, put a gun to his head, and the other one overdosed. And, you know, so the disease is alive and well in my family still. Not everybody makes it, you know. A lot of the people that I came in with, very few of them are still here. And it's because, you know, like, it's, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, sobriety gives us an opportunity to get busy in life. And we're sharing about complacency, the topic complacency at a meeting just recently. And that's true. But I was so fortunate to have a sponsor that got me involved in service to Alcoholics Anonymous, for being a greeter, coffee maker, serving coffee. We cleaned the coffee cups afterwards. I was real grateful for the cakes and cookies that they had at that time, because I didn't have money. I'm in that book about bankrupt. I was very bankrupt. And I ate a lot of cookies and cake. Maybe that's why I'm diabetic today. But, you know, that I survived. I really did. I survived. And what happened was, I worked the steps. I volunteered. I also got involved with hospital institution work, and I would strongly suggest anyone who's can do that, please do. I did it for many years in Fresno. I went to I carried the message to Carruthers Jail, where I was incarcerated. It's not there anymore, and they segregated us back then as well, and they put me with all the Mexicans. There's one thing I want to mention too. When I'm one of the first members of my family. My father's the eldest of 21 children from that one wife. My grandfather had two, never made a wife. And anyway, I come from a large family, and there were only three women in that line, and I'm only one of 11, so we always thought ourselves as a small family, you know, and it really was, not a good thing, because I had other cousins had 16, 18 in their family, and they would look at my mom like, well, what's wrong with you, you know? There was nothing wrong with my mom. She was an enabler, though, that's for sure. It was my dad who was the alcoholic. But anyway, what happening was for myself is that coming to these rooms and then doing the service work that I did and going, you know, carrying the message to Brothers Jail until they finally closed, and I started taking the message up to the Miramonte prison. And sometimes we'd have one guy, well, sometimes we had six guys, but I needed to see that. I don't see people in Alcoholics Anonymous like I used to when I first was brought here, shaking, smelling of alcohol. The white people had red blotches on their face, you know, and I know now that was because of the alcoholism, and I could see them getting better. I see the white people getting healthier and better looking, but I couldn't see it in myself until I started working the steps with my sponsor. And when he got me going to book studies, that was the clincher for me. And I want to mention this because it's very important. For someone like me, so different than that, you would not understand me. You can't possibly understand what I have been through and what I've endured. And that's bullshit. I mean, that's what I was telling myself. When I was fortunate enough, nothing is by mistake in my life. The God in my life. And I went to a book study early on, and they were discussing and talking about Tradition 3. And they were talking about the only requirement for AA membership is a desire, an honest desire to not drink. And that was a clincher for me. And it's like, they can't kick me out because I was a man whore, you know. It's like, you know, all these things, you know, that I was, I had these labels on me. I thought that once you find out who I was and what I had done and what kind of thief I was and how, you know, the twisted stuff that alcohol, drugs, and the places I went to and the things that I did. I belonged with a group called the Fresno Underground, and it was pretty wild. And they couldn't kick me out. You couldn't kick me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could finally be okay in these rooms. And because of that, I've had an amazing life. I have, like I said, problems and heartache. I could no longer numb the emotions with alcohol, so things became real for me. And I'm so grateful that my sponsor was Bill Moore, old-time AA, that he helped me with my prejudices, helped me understand what it means to be a member of this program. And it talks about in the second chapter, you know, we normally would not mix. I wouldn't mix with you unless you had enough drugs and alcohol to keep me happy, you know, or if your husband was good looking, you know. You know, I mean, that was really, it was pretty twisted. When I was in, I do want to mention, when I went to college, that was the other thing, taking that direction from a white person. You know, I went for business administration. And I want to mention this because back then they told us, you know, if you're in business administration, he goes, you got to cut your hair, wear a white shirt, blue slacks, black shirt, or black shoes, and black belt, you know. So I did what the white guy said, you know, I cut my hair, did all this stuff, you know. I was always just a little, but I felt awful about doing that kind of stuff. I really did. It was so years and years later where I understood that that's against, you know, taking away my rights as a Native person, a First Nation person, you know. But again, it was about the mixed messages that I was receiving. And what I've come to understand that with, because of Tradition 3, it allows me to be present here and to get to know you so we can help each other, because it's a we program. I was an extremely selfish young man. And if you had something I wanted, you know, I'd be going, I'm going to take it. Whether you give it to me or not, it didn't matter. You know, I was not a nice person. Because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm the best Reyes that there's ever been. It's just not always about saying if you're being funny or entertaining like that. This is real shit. Oh, stop, I don't like touching either, but this is real stuff. It really is. Because I've been around long enough to see amazing men and women die horrible deaths. I had a friend of mine, I don't want to talk about a lot about those people, said those are the types of situations that happen in my sobriety. that remind me that that's what could happen. A friend of mine, who only drank wine, and a really good looking guy, his name was Sam, and he blew his house up with himself in it on purpose because he couldn't stop drinking. I was already sober by that time. A friend of mine, a really good friend of mine, Joe, put a shotgun, not a regular gun, a shotgun in his mouth and blew the back of his head off because he couldn't stop drinking. A very good friend of mine, Tommy, was pissed off at his wife because she was going to leave him because of his drinking and take the two kids. So he was going to show her, and he hung himself in the garage so when she came home that she would find him. Well, that particular day, for some reason, school got out early, and his daughter and son found Tom, my friend, hanging in the garage. You know, things like that have happened. Those are real stuff. It's all because, but the thing is, I understand that thinking. It says in the big book, you know, about the spiritual malady. I was sick. I was, like I said, bankrupt in all areas of my affairs. And I can go on for hours about the men and women I've known that have died horrible deaths. One of my best friends, an ex-Marine, he was like, yeah, white guy, big white guy. And he was like 6'5", big guy. And he liked hanging around with me because I drank like he could drink. We'd go to places just to intimidate other white people, like the Top Hat and Clovis, stuff like that, where it was only white people were lonely. And I'd walk in and everyone would look at me, you know, and then he'd walk in behind me and we'd go, just to poke at people, you know. And he died in four-point restraints and a diaper with tubes hanging out. And I drank like he drank. And I got angry at a guy that I didn't believe in because he was taking all my friends. It says in the book I can seek outside help, which I did. I understand what survivor's guilt is. And I was angry at God for taking my friends. You know, why doesn't he take me? You know, I'm the bad guy. You know, I did all this stuff, you know. When I did my inventory with my sponsor, I didn't understand how this program worked. I thought I had one shot at sobriety, so I was extremely thorough with my four step. And the spiritual principle of that four step is honesty. And when I finally was able to sit down with my sponsor to do a fifth step, he literally had to rip the pages out of my hand and just, you know, goes, "Now read it to me." And we, you know, we had this whole process. We pray together and do the work together. And the column where it was affected my, you know, and I was pissed off, I was angry, upset. He goes, "Everywhere you put, you were angry or pissed off." He goes, "We're going to find out what you're afraid of." And that's one thing you don't tell me at that time. And that pissed me off with my sponsor. You don't know what I've been through. What am I afraid of? And that's what it was. It was my anger was a mask for the fears in my life. The fear of being touched because of what happened to me as a kid. The fear of not looking good. The fear of not being loved because I was unlovable. It was all these behaviors that I was doing that made me unlovable, untrustworthy. You don't put a fox in the hen house or the cock house. I don't care which one you call it. Just don't go there. Today, I understand what lust is. True, you know. I understand what. I do want to share this because people think it's kind of funny, but it's really true. It's again what how sick I was. I was sharing with my sponsor, you know, because I was. I never had one of anything. Never thought about having one drink, one anything, one line, nothing. And I had 12 boyfriends. This is not a long time ago. This is like 30 some years ago. Okay, I'm not making this up. What I ended up doing was I was feeling bad, and I never felt bad because alcohol always suppressed my emotions and stuff, and when I stole or did things, or if I broke a bone, it would numb it. Well, I didn't have that number anymore. I didn't have that medicine. So what I was doing, I was cheating on these 12 guys with other guys, you know, so that's what I was feeling bad about. And I was talking to my sponsor to get some help and direction, and he started talking to me about monogamy. And I'm sitting there getting pissed off more and more at my sponsor, because what the hell is he talking to me about wood? You know, because I kept thinking, I thought he was talking about mahogany. And I'm serious, I'm not making this up. This is how ignorant I was and how angry and twisted I was and why I need you. I need all of you, whether you like it or not. We all walk different paths and we all have different information. And it's a true story. It really is. I finally had to tell my sponsor that he was pissing me off and he couldn't understand why. And I didn't understand. I didn't know what monogamy was. And because I understand what that word is today, my last relationship lasted 15 years. And 13 years of that with that man was like a honeymoon. You know, we had a ranch in Fresno and all that stuff and traveled well. I travel well. I remember my trips now. I've been to Europe twice, 3 months one time and 2 months, 2.5 months the second time. I speak different languages besides my Mezcaloro or Indy. I learned German when I was early on in my life. I speak Hrvatska, which is Croatian. I learned conversational Chinese when I was in college because I met some guys from Red China because I wanted to change and fit in. Now I do it because I can go and be respectful of other people. Like I can be respectful of women in meetings and I can be respectful of myself on a daily basis. So today what it's like is that when I wake up, not when I come to, you know, I can make my bed, I can go out, I face east, I talk to my creator, I remind myself every morning, this is what I do, I remind myself every morning that I'm an addict, I'm an alcoholic, and I ask what I can do for the still suffering person or somebody else. Because that helps me on a daily basis be less selfish. And I pray for those who I know right now are hurting, who have relapsed. I only have one sobriety date, but that's, you know, I've been around long enough to think, you know, I'm not kidding myself. I think people a lot of time go back out because they get too busy or they get a resentment and they don't apply the program and the spiritual program to their lives. And what happens? They die a horrible death or they kill somebody else. I've had family members. I've had family members go to prison for killing somebody drinking and driving. And I thought, man, what assholes, you know? How sick are they? I never applied it to myself. And for years, I was a blackout drunk driver. I could have easily killed somebody, easily killed a child. My brother-in-law went to prison for killing a girl here in Visalia some years ago when she was 25 years of age. My uncle killed a girl near Goshen. She was 16, and he went to prison. So it's alive and well, and I need to see that kind of stuff when I come to meetings and listen. I listen today for the similarities, not the differences. I'm an example, good or bad, that this program works. It says in the book, we do recover. I recover from a seemingly hopeless disease. I am an example from all the shit that I've gone through as a little kid, from what the mixed messages that were instilled in me by beatings, by sexual abuse, by the eating disorder that I ended up with because I didn't like vomiting, so I wouldn't eat so I could drink because I didn't have the money to buy the booze and I didn't want to waste it, so I would go for long periods of time without eating, so I ended up with a disorder for food addiction, for food. Food scared me. And again, it was the steps and how my sponsor showed me. We went through it. The first step is the only step is in two parts and the only one that says alcohol in it. The rest is about living life. And that's what I've learned to do. I've gone through the steps with my alcoholism, with my drug addiction, with my sex addiction, with my mental issues. I've gone through the steps applying them to the stuff that helps me today. I'm a human being. I make mistakes. That's what the 10th step is for. And I know today if I don't want to do the time, I better not do the crime. If I don't want to make amends to somebody, I better be stay spiritually fit so that I have to go up to you and say, hey, I was wrong. Not I was sorry, but I was wrong because I was talking behind your back, which I don't like. I'd rather talk to your face and try to start a fight, you know. Then God, but I tell people I was wrong because it's mending me. I have my sponsor, and I'll set it up with this. He talked to me about the visualization of a vase that had been broken. He goes, and you put it together, you glue it and so forth, and it's a viable vase. It can hold water and have beautiful flowers and have a bouquet and enjoy that beauty. He goes, but it's still cracked and flawed. That's me. I'm cracked and I'm flawed. But because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the amazing men and women and the friends of these that I made in this room, you know, I can stand up here and share the tip of the iceberg of the insanity. And it talks about it in the big book, the plain insanity of this disease. And I will hope and pray that something that says makes sense for somebody tonight, that you're not alone, regardless of what you've done. And I will close with this. I've always, was for a lot of years, I was hoping one of my sponsors would share with me something that was as worse than mine, in his fifth step with me, or her fifth step. And last year, one did. I was like, whoa. I said, don't write about that. You know, because I'm not here to judge somebody. I'd rather them stay sober. I've helped members who were members of KKK, the White family, one of my best friends. And because of the third tradition, I don't have an opinion on outside issues. I'm here because I'm an alcoholic. The men and women that come in here, regardless of what your beliefs are, out there is yours. If you call me in the middle of the night, you need some help. You know, as long as I'm staying spiritually fit and I'm sober, I'm going to be there for you. Because I'll share with you this. All my 12-step calls have been a success because I'm still sober. Thank you. Bless you all.